Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 22nd Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today, we'll be reading the following main articles. Brewing Conflict in Europe, War Fears Grow, by Vladimir Ishchenkov, Yuris Karmanow, and Lauren Cook. Denver Homeless Shelters, FEMA, Money Not Coming. City may lose $32 million in reimbursements from agency. Facilities will remain open, by Joe Rubino. Commerce City, DA, 5 dead in apartment, likely overdosed on fentanyl, by Shelley Bradbury and Elise Schmelzer. And COVID-19, studies, initial doses effective for long period, by Apoorva Mandavilli. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Brewing conflict in Europe. War fears grow. Putin orders troops into eastern Ukraine. Russian president claims separatist areas independent. Angers West, by Vladimir Ishchenkov, Yuris Karmanow, and Lauren Cook. The Associated Press, byline Moscow. A long-feared Russian invasion of Ukraine appeared to be imminent Monday, if not already underway, with Russian President Vladimir Putin ordering forces into separatist regions of eastern Ukraine. A vaguely worded decree signed by Putin did not say if troops were on the move, and it cast the order as an effort to maintain peace. But it appeared to dash the slim remaining hopes of averting a major conflict in Europe that could cause massive casualties, energy shortages on the continent, and economic chaos around the globe. Putin's directive came hours after he recognized the separatist areas in a rambling, fact-bending discourse on European history. The move paved the way to provide them military support, antagonizing Western leaders who regard such a move as a breach of world order, and set off a frenzied scramble by the U.S. and others to respond. Underscoring the urgency, the U.N. Security Council held a rare nighttime emergency meeting on Monday at the request of Ukraine, the U.S., and other countries. Undersecretary General Rosemary DiCarlo opened the session with the warning that the risk of major conflict is real and needs to be prevented at all costs. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky sought to project calm, telling the country, "We are not afraid of anyone or anything. We don't owe anyone anything, and we won't give anything to anyone." The White House issued an executive order to prohibit U.S. investment and trade in the separatist regions, and additional measures, likely sanctions, were to be announced Tuesday. Those sanctions are independent of what Washington has prepared in the event of a Russian invasion, according to a senior administration official who briefed reporters on the condition of anonymity. The developments came amid a spike in skirmishes in the eastern regions that Western powers believe Russia could use as a pretext for an attack on the Western-looking democracy that has defied Moscow's attempt to put it back into its orbit. Putin justified his decision in a far-reaching pre-recorded speech blaming NATO for the current crisis and calling the U.S.-led alliance an existential threat to Russia. Sweeping through more than a century of history, he painted today's Ukraine as a modern construct that is inextricably linked to Russia. He charged that Ukraine had inherited Russia's historic lands, and after the Soviet collapse, was used by the West to contain Russia. I consider it necessary to take a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of Donetsk People's Republic and Luhansk People's Republic, Putin said. Afterward, he signed decrees recognizing the Donetsk and Luhansk regions' independence 8 years after fighting erupted between Russian-backed separatists and Ukrainian forces, and called on lawmakers to approve measures paving the way for military support. Until now, Ukraine and the West have accused Russia of supporting the separatists, but Moscow has denied that, saying that Russians who fought there were volunteers. Recognizing the separatist region's independence is likely to be popular in Russia, where many share Putin's worldview. Russian state media released images of people in Donetsk launching fireworks, waving large Russian flags, and playing Russia's national anthem. Ukrainians in Kyiv, meanwhile, bristled at the move. Why should Russia recognize the rebel-held regions? If neighbors come to you and say, "This room will be ours," would you care about their opinion or not? It's your flat, and it will be always your flat, said Maria Leshchenkina, a 48-year-old painter in the Ukrainian capital. Let them recognize whatever they want, but in my view, it can also provoke a war because normal people will fight for their country. With an estimated 150,000 Russian troops massed on three sides of Ukraine, the U.S. has warned that Moscow has already decided to invade. Still, Biden and Putin tentatively agreed to a meeting brokered by French President Emmanuel Macron in a last-ditch effort to avoid war. If Russia moves in, the meeting will be off. But the prospect of a face-to-face summit resuscitated hopes in diplomacy to prevent a conflict that could cause massive casualties and huge economic damage across Europe, which is heavily dependent on Russian energy. Russia said it wants Western guarantees that NATO won't allow Ukraine and other former Soviet countries to join as members. And Putin said Monday that a simple moratorium on Ukraine's accession wouldn't be enough. Moscow has also demanded the alliance halt weapons deployments to Ukraine and roll back its forces from Eastern Europe, demands flatly rejected by the West. Macron's office said both leaders had accepted the principle of such a summit to be followed by a broader meeting that would include other relevant stakeholders to discuss security and strategic stability in Europe. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, meanwhile, said the administration has always been ready to talk to avert a war, but was also prepared to respond to any attack. Putin's announcement shattered a 2015 peace deal signed in Minsk, requiring Ukrainian authorities to offer broad self-rule to the rebel regions, a major diplomatic coup for Moscow. That deal was resented by many in Ukraine who saw it as a capitulation, a blow to the country's integrity, and a betrayal of national interests. Putin and other officials argued Monday that Ukrainian authorities have shown no appetite for implementing it. More than 14,000 people have been killed since conflict erupted in the eastern industrial heartland in 2014, shortly after Moscow annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Potential flashpoints multiplied. Sustained shelling continued Monday along the tense line of contact, separating the opposing forces. Unusually, Russia said it had fended off an incursion from Ukraine, which Ukrainian officials denied, and Russia decided to prolong military drills in Belarus, which could offer a staging ground for an attack on the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. Ukraine and the separatist rebels have traded blame for massive ceasefire violations in hundreds of explosions recorded daily. While separatists have charged that Ukrainian forces were firing on residential areas, Associated Press journalists reported from several towns and villages in Ukrainian-held territory along the line of contact have not witnessed any notable escalation from the Ukrainian side and have documented signs of intensified shelling by the separatists that destroyed homes and ripped up roads. Some residents of the main rebel-held city of Donetsk describe sporadic shelling by Ukrainian forces, but they added that it wasn't on the same scale as earlier in the conflict. The separatist authorities said Monday that at least 4 civilians were killed by Ukrainian shelling over the past 24 hours, and several others were wounded. Ukraine's military said 2 Ukrainian soldiers were killed over the weekend, and another serviceman was wounded Monday. Ukrainian military spokesman Pavlo Kovalchuk insisted Ukrainian forces weren't returning fire. In another worrying sign, the Russian military said it killed 5 suspected saboteurs who crossed from Ukraine into Russia's Rostov region and also destroyed 2 armored vehicles and took a Ukrainian serviceman prisoner. Ukrainian Border Guard spokesman Andreev Dymchenko dismissed the claim as disinformation. Denver homeless shelters, FEMA, money not coming. City may lose $32 million in reimbursements from agency. Facilities will remain open. By Joe Rubino, The Denver Post. A dispute between Denver officials and administrators with the Federal Emergency Management Agency could cost the city close to $32 million. Money already spent on homeless shelters last year that FEMA is poised to refuse to reimburse. Ongoing funding for the city's congregate shelters, group shelters where people sleep in the same large room, could also be impacted by FEMA's pending decision. But city officials are adamant its facilities and services will not be immediately impacted if a new source of funding has to be identified. This doesn't mean that our shelters are closing, Denver Department of Finance spokeswoman Julie Smith said. People are still going to be able to access our shelters and services. The dust-up, first reported by the Denver Gazette, hinges on a reimbursement request city officials filed on November 19th, seeking roughly $40.6 million from FEMA for a variety of costs related to sheltering people experiencing homelessness amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The request covered the period from July 1st through December 31st, 2021. FEMA has already authorized nearly $84 million in payments supporting city shelter programs between March 2020 and June of last year. But agency officials say that city and state leaders' decisions to roll back public health orders, specifically those dealing with reducing the density of people in homeless shelters, disqualified some services from reimbursement. We have had regular, reoccurring meetings with the state and also with the city, said Zach Lamb, FEMA's Response Division Director for Region 8, which includes Colorado. He said those meetings have included discussions about what would happen if the city or state government rescinded certain health orders. We have been consistent with our messaging around what would be impacted, Lamb said, from kind of the beginning, middle of 2021, throughout. City officials don't see it that way. They maintain that congregate shelter facilities are covered as something FEMA should support under the Stafford Act, the federal law that provides the framework for federal disaster response. I was surprised. We have had a really good relationship with them. They worked with us, Margaret Danuser, Denver's Deputy Chief Financial Officer, said of FEMA and its willingness to reimburse the city for COVID-19 expenses. This kind of came out of left field, in a way. A project worksheet submitted on November 19th that the city shared with the Denver Post outlines expenses, including hotel rooms used to shelter people who were high risk or may have been positive for COVID-19, and costs related to congregate shelters, including close to $3.9 million paid to the Salvation Army. The Salvation Army was one of the organizations that ran the city's emergency shelter inside the Denver Coliseum before it closed in December, city officials say. The city has since learned that between $9.4 million and $16.8 million of that request, the pieces covering congregate shelters like the Colosseum, may be rejected. It is very likely that there is a big chunk of that is related to the congregate shelters piece that is not going to be eligible, said Ryan Pietramali, FEMA's Acting Deputy Region 8 Administrator. Pietramali specifically referenced Governor Jared Polis lifting the state's health emergency declaration on July 8th when discussing changes at the city and state level that are shaping FEMA's decision on the request. Lamb said Denver is unique in receiving public assistance funding for congregate shelters, but Denver officials dispute that too. Anchorage, Alaska has been receiving FEMA money to use a hockey rink to de-densify its homeless shelters, according to Dan Uzer. Denver officials have been in touch with counterparts in that city, she said. The city still has a pending request, filed with FEMA in April, for $15.2 million used to retrofit and operate a warehouse on East 48th Avenue as a shelter. That also may not be covered, FEMA officials confirmed. A final decision won't be made until next week at the soonest, but the options FEMA is presenting to the city are to strip out ineligible costs from its reimbursement request and file them separately, or stick with the current filing and await a determination memo, said Lamb. The city, in efforts to speed payments for some things last spring, took a similar approach with a reimbursement request for close to $15.2 million used to build out and operate a new shelter on 48th Avenue. That request remains outstanding too, adding up to nearly $32 million in disputed repayments. We certainly have been thinking about their proposal to sort of strip out things. That may be a path forward for at least the larger portion of the November submission that is non-congregate care, Dan Ozer said. We would still like to finish out the larger conversation around congregate care and the applicability under the Stafford Act for that. In the meantime, the city has relied on other pots of money, including the budgets of some city agencies and a COVID-19 emergency special revenue fund to support its shelters. There is an appeals process available should FEMA deny the city, Dan Ozer said. She's hoping that isn't necessary. The city will keep serving this most vulnerable part of the community in a very safe fashion, she said. Nothing is urgent or dire at this point. We just want to make sure we are reimbursed for every dime we are eligible for. Commerce City, DA, 5 dead in apartment likely overdosed on fentanyl, by Shelley Bradbury and Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. The 5 people who died inside a Commerce City apartment over the weekend likely overdosed unintentionally on fentanyl, 17th Judicial District Attorney Brian Mason said Monday. Preliminary testing and other evidence suggest the 5 victims believe they were ingesting cocaine Sunday and did not realize the drug had been laced with fentanyl, Mason said. All 5 likely died almost instantly, he said. The 5 deaths come as Colorado's fentanyl overdose crisis continues to worsen and policymakers scramble to address the deadly opioid. An average of 2 Coloradans died of fentanyl overdoses every day in the first 9 months of 2021, state data shows. No drug is safe, Mason said, because any drug could literally have fentanyl in it without the user knowing. We're finding it in cocaine. We're finding it in heroin. We're finding it in meth. In limited cases, we're even seeing it with marijuana. Commerce City police found the bodies of 3 women and 2 men around 3:45 p.m. Sunday inside a home at the North Range Crossings Apartments at 14480 East 104th Avenue. Another adult and a 4-month-old infant were in the apartment but survived, Commerce City Police Chief Clint Nichols said Sunday night. The victims have not been publicly identified, but the women who died were ages 28, 29, and 32, police said, and the men were ages 32 and 24. Mason warned that the tainted batch of drugs could still be circulating in the community. It is the nightmare scenario of the dangers of fentanyl, he said. There are other people out there who might have drugs from that same batch or have drugs from the same dealer who could take those drugs tonight. And we have more deaths. It's a terrifying public health, public safety crisis. Commerce City Police are heading up the investigation into the deaths, along with the North Metro Drug Task Force and the District Attorney's Office, Mason said. He declined to speculate on whether charges would be filed against the person who provided the drugs to the five victims. Police said in a news release Monday that they were aggressively pursuing leads with plans to vigorously pursue charges. Obviously, an investigation of this nature is very complicated, he said. There are five folks who are dead. We can't interview them, ask them where the drugs came from, and that makes these cases very challenging. And quite honestly, the drug cartels know that when they are distributing these drugs. Mason said it was miraculous that one person survived the incident. He declined to say whether the survivor also ingested the tainted drugs, but said the person was rushed to a hospital for treatment. A next-door neighbor to the apartment, Ian Scott, told the Denver Post he was alerted to the deaths by the screams of a distraught woman who appeared high Sunday afternoon. Both the adult and the baby are expected to survive. It's unclear if the baby's parents were among the dead. Fentanyl has been surging in Colorado for the last 2 years, Mason said, as drug makers use the cheaper, more addictive option to boost their profits. Preliminary data from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment shows that at least 767 people died of fentanyl overdoses in 2021, though deaths in the last 3 months are still being counted and the final number will be higher. Approximately half of the 1,581 Colorado drug overdose deaths last year that have been recorded thus far involved fentanyl, the provisional data shows. Of those 1,581 people, 618 died of methamphetamine, 227 died of cocaine, 167 died of heroin, and 55 of alcohol. Even without full data for the last 3 months, the 2021 death toll is a 42% increase from the 540 deaths recorded in 2020. Colorado's age-adjusted rate of fentanyl overdoses has increased fivefold from the rate of 1.7 per 100,000 people recorded in 2018 to 9.29 in 2020. Final 2021 mortality data will be available in May. Kirk Ball, manager of CDPHE's Vital Statistics Program, said in an email. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser said Monday that the deaths in Commerce City show prosecutors and investigators need more resources in order to better address surging fentanyl use. He and Mason in December called for harsher penalties for people who sell fentanyl, and Weiser reiterated that stance, calling on lawmakers to create either a new charge or a sentence enhancer for people who sell drugs that result in the customer's death. Typically, the charge of distributing drugs resulting in death is easier to prove in court than a murder count, he said, though the specific elements and penalties would depend on how changes to the law are written. Weiser said he expects to see such a bill introduced this year. When you distribute drugs and it results in someone's death, and you are essentially on notice that you could be doing this, it's not the same as when you distribute drugs and someone is feeding their addiction, he said, adding that he does not want to see increased criminal penalties for people suffering from addiction. It's rare but not unheard of for drug dealers in Colorado to be charged with murder in connection to overdose deaths. In December 2020, a 25-year-old Aurora man was charged with first-degree murder after he was accused of knowingly giving fentanyl to a 16-year-old girl who then overdosed and died. That case is pending trial. Another pending case is that of a 21-year-old Boulder County man who was charged with manslaughter in December after authorities there said he sold pills laced with fentanyl that resulted in a woman's fatal overdose. Boulder's Daily Camera newspaper reported. And in 2014, a centennial woman linked to four fatal overdoses was charged with first-degree murder in the 2011 overdose death of 21-year-old Carter Higdon. She pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to 18 years in prison. COVID-19. Studies. Initial doses effective for long period by Apoorva Mendavili, The New York Times Company. As people across the world grapple with the prospect of living with the coronavirus for the foreseeable future, one question looms large. How soon before they need another shot? Not for many months and perhaps not for years, according to a flurry of new studies. Three doses of a COVID-19 vaccine, or even just two, are enough to protect most people from serious illness and death for a long time, the studies suggest. We're starting to see now diminishing returns on the number of additional doses, said John Huary, director of the Institute for Immunology at the University of Pennsylvania. Although people who are over 65 or at high risk of illness may benefit from a fourth vaccine dose, it may be unnecessary for most people, he added. Federal health officials, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, the Biden administration's top COVID-19 advisor, have also said that they are unlikely to recommend a fourth dose before the fall. The Omicron variant can dodge antibodies, immune molecules that prevent the virus from infecting cells, produced after two doses of a COVID-19 vaccine. But a third shot of the mRNA vaccines made by Pfizer, BioNTech, or by Moderna prompts the body to make a much wider variety of antibodies, which would be difficult for any variant of the virus to evade, according to the most recent study. The diverse repertoire of antibodies produced should be able to protect people from new variants, even those that differ significantly from the original version of the virus, the study suggests. If people are exposed to another variant like Omicron, they now got some extra ammunition to fight it, said Dr. Julie McElraith, an infectious disease physician and immunologist at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. What's more, other parts of the immune system can remember and destroy the virus over many months, if not years, according to at least four studies published in top-tier journals over the past month. Specialized immune cells called T cells produced after immunization by four brands of COVID-19 vaccine, Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and Novavax, are about 80% as powerful against Omicron as other variants, the research found. Given how different Omicron's mutations are from previous variants, it is very likely that T cells would mount a similarly robust attack on any future variant as well, researchers said. This matches what scientists have found for the SARS coronavirus, which killed nearly 800 people in a 2003 epidemic in Asia. In people exposed to that virus, T cells have lasted more than 17 years. Evidence so far indicates that the immune cells for the new coronavirus, sometimes called memory cells, may also decline very slowly, experts said. Memory responses can last for years, said Wendy Burgers, an immunologist at the University of Cape Town, who led one of the studies, published in the journal Nature. Potentially, the T cell response is extremely long-lived. Throughout the pandemic, a disproportionate amount of research attention has gone to antibodies, the body's first line of defense against a virus. That is partly because these molecules are relatively easy to study. They can be measured from a drop of blood. Waning antibody levels after two vaccine doses prompted federal officials to recommend boosters for everyone older than 12. The extra shots fortified antibody levels and helped to contain Omicron spread, but they too appear to lose some of their ability to prevent infections within 4 months, according to recent data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Antibodies recognize two or three key parts of the spike protein. a protrusion on the outside of the coronavirus that allows it to hatch onto human cells. But T cells detect many more parts of the spike and so are less likely to fail when the virus gains mutations in some of them. Vaccines also encode a memory of the virus in B cells, which can churn out fresh batches of antibodies within 4 or 5 days after a new exposure to the virus. This dual punch of T and B cells helps explain why many people who received 2 or even 3 doses of vaccine could still be infected with the Omicron variant, but only a small percentage became seriously ill. You will see a decrease of the antibody levels over time, but if memory B cells are still there and memory T cells are still there, they can kick back into action relatively quickly, said Alessandra Sette, an immunologist at the La Jolla Institute for Immunology who led a new study of T cells published in Cell. Memory B cells become increasingly sophisticated over time, and they learn to recognize a diverse set of viral genetic sequences. The longer they have to practice, the broader the range of virus variants they can thwart. Researchers showed last year that the elite school inside of lymph nodes, where the B cells train, called the germinal center, remains active for at least 15 weeks after the second dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. In an updated study published in the journal Nature, the same team showed that 6 months after vaccination, memory B cells continue to mature, and the antibodies they produce keep gaining the ability to recognize new variants. Those antibodies at 6 months are better binders and more potent neutralizers than the ones that are produced 1 month after immunization, said Ali Alabedi, an immunologist at Washington University in St. Louis who led the study. In the newest study, another team showed that a third shot creates an even richer pool of B cells than the second shot did, and the antibodies they produce recognize a broader range of variants. In laboratory experiments, these antibodies were able to fend off the Beta, Delta, and Omicron variants. In fact, more than half of the antibodies seen 1 month after a third dose were able to neutralize Omicron, even though the vaccine was not designed for that variant, the study found. If you've had a third dose, you're going to have a rapid response that's going to have quite a bit of specificity for Omicron, which explains why people that have had a third dose do so much better, said Mikael Nusenweg, an immunologist at Rockefeller University, who led the study. Forecast: frigid cold, snow expected for next few days, by Elizabeth Hernandez, The Denver Post. Forecasters expected frigid temperatures and light snow to greet Denverites on Tuesday morning following a warm, sunny weekend, a drastic swing that epitomizes Colorado's winter weather trickery. According to the National Weather Service in Boulder, Denver could see a high of just 13 degrees Tuesday, with wind chills that could reach as low as -8 degrees, a far cry from the 60-degree weekend much of the Front Range experienced. Around 1 to 2 inches of snow was expected to fall overnight in Denver as temperatures drop, said Evan Dorenzo, National Weather Service meteorologist. The strong cold front is expected to linger from Tuesday through Thursday, with about 3 to 6 inches of snow predicted throughout the front's duration, Dorenzo said. Wednesday is forecast to see a high of 18 degrees, while Thursday shows an expected high of 25 degrees. The snow is forecast to fall in a gradient across the Front Range, with more accumulation on the west side of town and gradually thinning out toward the east, Dorenzo said. Snow will end by Thursday morning, and temperatures will gradually warm into the 30s by Friday, Dorenzo said. The Colorado Department of Transportation warned that with an extended winter storm settling over the state, drivers should be careful and expect moderate to heavy snowfall in the mountains through Thursday morning, with lighter snowfall over the eastern plains, and 1 to 4 feet of snow is forecast in the central and southwestern mountains, CDOT officials said. with heavier snow accumulations expected west of Interstate 25, CDOT officials said plows will be out in force, but that drivers should expect slick and hazardous road conditions throughout the state. This winter season has been a display of extremes. NWS meteorologist Russell Danielson said, "We've had both extremes this winter, which is kind of crazy," Danielson said. "The beginning of the cold season all the way through New Year's Eve was the driest, least snowiest on record for Denver. And then we flipped the script. From January 1st through February 17th, we were toward the snowiest on record. We flipped it on its head toward the better. But boy, do we wish that happened sooner and before the Marshall Fire." Several Front Range locations are topping the NWS list for the snowiest first 7 weeks of a year. Boulder saw 45.7 inches of snow from January 1st through February 17th, when on average the city receives 20.6 inches during the same time frame. The Denver Central Park area got 28.4 inches of snow when it normally sees 11.3 inches on average during that time frame. Fort Collins, which usually receives 11.5 inches of snow during the year's first several weeks, took a 20.9 inch coating this year. "We're hoping to continue this snowier trend to help with the drought," Danielson said. Anti-Semitic flyers found around Metro neighborhood. From Colette Bordelon, Denver 7. On Sunday morning, people living in certain Parker neighborhoods woke up to anti-Semitic flyers on their front yards. The flyers, found in plastic bags filled with rice, state that every single aspect of the COVID agenda is Jewish. At the bottom of the paper, it says the flyers were distributed randomly and without malicious intent. However, those who discovered them on Sunday believe the motivation behind the flyers is inherently malicious. "It's upsetting. It's disturbing. I have no words, really," said one neighbor who wanted to remain anonymous. "No matter your religion, no matter your beliefs, it is offensive." Ken Buffington believes he caught the moment a driver threw a flyer into his yard on a home security camera. His daughter found it in the morning while taking their dog outside. "I was born Catholic and my wife is Jewish and my kids were raised Jewish," Buffington said, telling Denver 7 his wife and daughter were rattled by the flyers. Buffington said he reported the flyers to the Parker Police Department. A representative from the department said they are aware of the flyers, but they are protected under the First Amendment. Those with the department said they will not be investigating the flyers further because they are not criminal in nature. Shang-Chi, actor to speak at CU Boulder. The first Asian-Canadian actor to star in a Marvel Studio superhero film will speak this week at the University of Colorado Boulder. Actor Simu Liu, known for his role in Marvel's Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings, will give a talk Wednesday night as part of an event sponsored by CU Boulder's student-run Distinguished Speakers and Cultural Events Boards. His accomplishments as an actor, producer, and soon-to-be author set him apart as someone truly extraordinary, said CEB Chair Anuja Gore in a news release. In addition to his Ten Rings role, Liu starred in the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and Netflix comedy series Kim's Convenience. This is by Annie Mill of the Times Call. Hancock at South High. Mayor teaches classes to call attention to sub shortage, by Melanie Asmar, Chalkbeat, Colorado. Wearing a checked dress shirt in South High's colors of purple and white, Denver Mayor Michael Hancock gave the juniors and seniors in Friday's fourth period advanced placement government class a one-question pop quiz. "True or false," he said. "The foundational value of our democracy is voting." There was a pause, not an extraordinarily long pause, but not a short one either. It was the kind of pause any substitute teacher might get before a girl in the back quietly answered that voting may have been central to the founding of our democracy, but not everyone was allowed to do it. That history and how efforts to block some voters from exercising their rights persist today were central to a lesson Hancock taught to three classes Friday. His guest appearance at South had dual purposes: to talk to students about a topic he's passionate about and to call attention to Denver Public Schools' pandemic-era substitute teacher shortage. It underscores the need we have to get professionals who have time to come into the schools and help out, Hancock said of the reason for his visit. Staff shortages have been a defining and difficult element of the COVID-19 pandemic at schools across the country. Teachers exposed to COVID-19, sick with COVID, or caring for sick family members have been quarantined at home, sometimes for weeks in a row. Schools are struggling to find substitutes who will risk their health for relatively low pay. Several Colorado districts have asked parents to help. New Mexico called on its National Guard. The Denver district has tried to make subbing more enticing by increasing the daily pay to $200 for those with a teaching license and $160 for those without one, said spokesperson Scott Pribble. The district also started reimbursing for state licensing costs and is offering a $400 bonus for subs who work at least 10 days per month, he said. During the recent Omicron wave, Superintendent Alex Marrero reinstituted a rule that employees who work in the district's central office must substitute in a school one day per week. Even with that support, and with the nearly 600 new substitute teachers Denver has hired since fall, the district can only fill about 63% of teacher absences each day, Pribble said. That's down from 83% in the 2019-20 school year, which was interrupted by COVID-19. Dozens of Denver schools had to temporarily switch to virtual learning last month due to staff shortages. The need for more subs came up repeatedly in an anonymous survey of 601 school staff members conducted by Denver's District Accountability Committee in December. "We don't have enough coverage when teachers are sick," one teacher wrote. Though Hancock was in command of the fourth period class at South, he wasn't really subbing. The actual teacher was sitting at a school desk next to his students, as well as a member of the mayor's security detail, his deputy communications director, and a reporter. But Hancock taught an hour-plus lesson that included PowerPoint slides, a video, and an opportunity for the students to write a one-minute speech to Congress about whether to pass two pending bills related to voter rights. The mayor was at ease in the classroom, leaning against a desk as he cold called on students whose names he'd quickly memorize. "Knowing there are efforts to restrict and suppress voting, how does that make you feel?" Hancock asked the students after telling them about an order by the Texas governor limiting the number of ballot drop-off locations in each county to one. "That's not what America is advertised to be," a student named Jack said. "What is America advertised to be?" Hancock prodded. "Free," Jack said, "to all people." Chalkbeat Colorado is a nonprofit news organization covering education issues. For more, visit co.chalkbeat.org. Analysis: How Biden's Trying to Prevent War, by Michael D. Shear, Julian E. Barnes, and Eric Schmidt. The New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. In a series of top secret meetings in October, President Joe Biden's national security team presented grim intelligence that would soon trigger a fierce effort to prevent what could become the largest armed conflict in Europe since World War II. Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, was preparing to invade Ukraine, top intelligence and military officials told Biden. Gathering each morning in the Oval Office, they described satellite images of Russian forces methodically advancing toward Ukraine's border. Not only did the United States have images of troops moving into position, it also had the Russian military's plans for a campaign against Ukraine, elements of which had already begun. At one of the morning meetings, Biden dispatched William J. Burns, a CIA director, to Moscow with the message for Putin: "We know what you're planning to do." Stopping him would be a challenge. The use of U.S. military force against Russia was off the table, so allies would have to threaten Putin with economic pain so severe it would also have consequences in Europe and the United States. On Monday, after delivering a grievance-filled speech attacking Ukraine's sovereignty, Putin ordered troops into two Russia-backed separatist regions in the country, but it remains unclear how far or quickly the Russian military will advance. And by day's end, the United States and its allies imposed only limited sanctions, reserving the full might of their response for moves that Putin might yet make. The White House acknowledged from the start that its campaign to stop Putin might not actually prevent Russia from invading Ukraine. But at the very least, White House officials say, Biden exposed Putin and his true intentions, which helped unite, at least for now, the at times fractious NATO alliance. Over the course of 3 months, Biden made three critical decisions about how to handle Russia's provocations, according to interviews with more than a dozen senior administration officials and others who requested anonymity to discuss confidential meetings. Early on, the president approved a recommendation to share intelligence far more broadly with allies than was typical, officials said. The idea was to avoid disagreements about tough economic sanctions by ensuring that everyone knew what the United States knew about Putin's actions. Biden also gave the green light for an unprecedented public information campaign against Putin. With the support of his top intelligence officials, the president allowed a wave of public releases aimed at preventing Putin from employing his usual denials to divide his adversaries. And when it became clear this year that Putin was continuing to build up forces at Ukraine's border, the president approved sending Ukraine more weapons, including Javelin anti-tank missiles, and deploying more troops to other countries in Eastern Europe as a show of solidarity with Ukraine and to reassure nervous allies on NATO's eastern flank. Battling big tech, Trump's social media app launches, by Bernard Condon, The Associated Press, Byline, New York. Former President Donald Trump's social media app that he hopes will rival Twitter launched Monday as he seeks a new digital stage to rally his supporters and fight big tech limits on speech a year after he was banned from Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. His Truth Social app was offered for download from the Apple App Store to a limited number of subscribers who had pre-ordered, with others added to a waiting list to be given access over the next 10 days. The site encountered technical glitches shortly after launch, with reports that subscribers were shut out for hours. Others had trouble signing on. The site is not expected to be open to anyone who wants to download it until next month. Due to massive demand, we have placed you on our wait list, read a pat message, some of those trying to access the platform said, adding, we love you. Trump is hoping Truth Social will attract the millions who followed him on Twitter as he hints at a third presidential run, triggering a wave of subscribers to justify the billions of dollars that investors have bet on the venture. Shares in a company that plans to buy Trump Media and Technology Group, the parent of Truth Social, have soared in recent months. According to Apple's rankings, Trump Social was the top free app in the U.S. on Monday morning, besting the Talking Ben the Dog children's game, streaming service HBO Max, TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook. The partial launch Monday follows an experimental beta launch to test the platform last week. Trump was banned from top social media platforms following the January 6th Capitol riot last year that critics accused him of inciting. The ban has raised difficult questions of free speech in a social media industry dominated by few tech giants, an issue that Trump and conservative media have seized upon. Republicans were quick to use the launch of Truth Social to raise money for their election efforts. After over a year of muzzling by the liberal big tech tyrants, Trump is back, wrote GOP House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy in a fundraising email appeal Monday. Groups like the Republican National Committee and the Congressional Leadership Fund also have been fundraising off the launch. Our main goal here is to give people their voice back, Trump Media CEO and former GOP Congressman Devin Nunes said Sunday on Fox News. He added that the app offers the opposite of some Silicon Valley tech oligarch freak telling people what they want to think and deciding who can and cannot be on the platform. Trump is hoping to tap into outrage over the social media bans to attract a broad audience to keep the stock rising and possibly hand him hundreds of millions of dollars personally. But he faces significant challenges. None of alternative messaging platforms already open to public, such as Gitter and Parler, have been able to move beyond an echo chamber of conservative political commentary. Trump's company, Trump Media, also faces financial hurdles. It has been promised nearly $300 million from a publicly traded company that plans to merge with it and got pledges from dozens of private investors for an additional $1 billion to fund its operations, but it still needs approval from regulators for the deal before it can access the cash. The company it hopes to merge with, Digital World Acquisition Corporation, has said regulators are investigating following reports that it may have broken security rules last year by talking to Trump representatives about possibly joining forces before selling stock to the public. Digital World is a so-called blank check company that is only allowed a quick path to going public without many disclosures if it has not identified a target to buy yet. Another regulatory investigation is focused on possible stock trading violations earlier in the fall. COVID-19 disruptions. A key to returning to normal is paid sick leave, Democrats say. By Claire Kane Miller, the New York Times Company. The Omicron wave hammered the American workforce, sending more people home sick than at any other point in the pandemic. Yet, unlike in 2020, there is no federally required paid sick leave for workers, and none at all for the one-fifth of workers who don't receive it from their employers. Now, as Omicron recedes and many restrictions are being lifted, and as more of the country begins to treat COVID-19 as an unavoidable part of life, some Democratic lawmakers and others are trying to revive paid leave for COVID-related reasons. In January, 2.3% of the American workforce was homesick, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, three times that of a typical pre-pandemic month. The disruptions have continued. In the last week of January and the first week of February, 12.8 million Americans did not work because they had COVID-19 or were caring for someone who did, or because their child's school or daycare was closed, a census survey found. That accounted for 21% of all adults who were not working and not retired. Another 3 million people didn't work because they were concerned about getting or spreading the virus. Whether they got paid sick leave and whether their jobs were protected depended on where they lived and worked. As we enter the endemic phase of COVID, it's a critical tool in returning to normal, said Vicky Shabo, senior fellow for paid leave policy and strategy at New America, a left-leaning policy group. The main idea Democrats are pursuing now is to include a new round of COVID-19 paid sick leave in the spending bill to fund the government, the deadline for which has been extended to March 11th. They are also considering a standalone paid sick leave bill or the inclusion of paid leave in a COVID-19 relief package for businesses. Yet, the United States remains one of 11 countries and the only rich country with no federal paid sick leave. During the pandemic, most wealthy nations in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development temporarily expanded their sick leave to cover people in quarantine and self-employed workers, and to relieve employers from paying for sick leave themselves. March 2020, the start of the pandemic, was the first time the United States offered comprehensive paid leave. The program expired in December that year. It gave 2 weeks to workers who were sick or needed to care for someone who was, and 12 weeks to care for children whose schools were closed. Employers were fully reimbursed in the form of a payroll tax credit. In Denver Wire Services news briefs, Colombia legalizes abortion up to 24 weeks. Byline, Bogota. Colombia became the latest country in Latin America to expand access to abortion Monday as the nation's constitutional court voted to legalize the procedure until the 24th week of pregnancy. The decision by the tribunal of 9 judges fell short of the expectations of pro-choice groups that had been pushing for abortion to be completely decriminalized in Colombia, but it was nevertheless described as an historic event by women's rights groups, which estimate 400,000 women get clandestine abortions in the country each year. Before the ruling, Colombia allowed abortions only when a woman's life was in danger, a fetus had malformations, or a pregnancy resulted from rape. Jury begins deliberating on if Arbery killing was a hate crime. Byline, Brunswick, Georgia. 3 white men who chased and killed Ahmaud Arbery on a residential street acted out of a pent-up racial anger and should be convicted of hate crimes, a federal prosecutor told the jury Monday. Defense attorneys argued that the black man was fatally shot in self-defense and had acted suspiciously during prior trips in the neighborhood. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.